Happy Friday.
I can't hear you, man.
Apologies, everybody. I'm having technical difficulties on my end here. Happy Friday, everybody. Welcome back to another Bioactive Live Q&A here with Mark and Kevin from OK Calyx Genetics. Brian's taking the night off with the family. He just had a baby boy a couple days ago, and luckily everybody's healthy and good, but we're just going to be flying duo tonight. So happy Friday, Kev.
Happy Friday, Mr. Mark. How is everybody? Oh, there was a mouse in my compost right now, man. I was just looking at it. Open that up, yeah. Little mouse ran in there.
Hell yeah. This is great. It's awesome that it's kind of a destiny pick here because Kevin's having technical issues on his end.
I'm on my phone, everybody, so it's a little different.
Yeah, so we're all struggling over here. My mic keeps disconnecting. All sorts of crazy shit. And then just a quick update from over here in Michigan. We had two tornadoes hit right in town here back on Tuesday. So that shut down power for a few days. It disrupted a couple of shipments going out on Tuesday. But luckily everybody's safe. Nobody got hurt. And
good.
That's business as usual for you guys out in Oklahoma. But here in Portage, Michigan, we don't get those often. That's a once every 50 to 100 year storm for us.
So. Oh, really?
Yeah.
Man, yeah. That's every Tuesday in May around here.
Yeah. Yeah. Nobody knows what to do when the tornado sirens start going off around here. yeah, so we're back again here to talk about composting, and there's nobody else probably better on the internet or in the world, honestly, to talk to about composting than Kevin here. And if you follow him on Instagram, you know that this is kind of his life. He's just standing in his backyard right now, and what you're seeing there is his different bins of compost that we'll go through. I know he wants to jump right into it, but we wanted to kind of tiptoe into it to let people know that we're open to the most basic questions. We're open to the complex questions. If you guys have questions, that's what we want with these Friday night sessions is to get your input, hopefully get you guys some information. And if not, we can find some information for ourselves.
Can you see the mouse in that hole? Well, he went back in now.
I see that hole. I didn't see it.
Earlier when you was talking, there's a mouse, the head sticking out of it.
And there you have an active compost mound there.
Yeah.
So yeah, Kev, I mean, so just to kind of start off with some basics here. What are you composting with? What materials what are good, what are bad, what's not good? Start with what you use, I guess, and then let's get into like what you don't use.
So we'll just kind of look at the compost right now. This I have three bins right here. These bins were gifted to me from a widow that lives in a house that's just right over there, and she was getting rid of stuff because she can't do much anymore, and I had no idea she even composted because they were behind her house, but she gave them to me. I used to compost in a tree barrel, like a barrel that they would grow trees in, a pretty good sized tree, you know. It was kind of big. It's about half the size of one of these, but it was just a small little barrel that I used. But now I've got these both of these two right here are just straight up from my kitchen table, from my mowed grass, from any kind of green manure around here that I use. Like you can see flowers are in there from the backyard that we picked and put on the table. This is processed compost. This is good to go. I'll scrape the top and you'll see how many red wigglers there are in there. It's just crazy. It's packed. It's basically like vermicompost going on. Anyway, we got eggshells. And yes, there's better things to do with these. If you want to, you know, use the calcium that's in them, you know, you'd use vinegar and that whole process. But I just put them in here. I don't crack them. I don't do anything. Pretty soon, those eggshells, these whole, the empty part right here, soon it will be full of food and bits and things like that. And then in the midsummer, late summer, there will be just tons of black soldier fly maggots just chowing down in here, and I'll take pictures of it. And I already know what's going to happen. We've got a apple. My kid's been eating banana peels. Now here's one thing: coffee grounds with the coffee bag, the coffee filter. You can compost the coffee filter. It's just the basic.
Are there some that you can and some that you cannot?
I'm sure there's some that you cannot. I'm sure some of them have printing on it or maybe flavored. I have no idea. We just get the basic paper ones that are recycled and you can recycle again. But it's ready. Okay, my computer's ready, so we might switch back here in a bit. Thank you. Broccoli, that was my wife, guys. She was helping me get it set up. Broccoli that we used. And then we've got some apple cores or apple peels. Now, what you're seeing on top right here is a bunch of mowed grass. These bags right here, these come from a mowing business from a guy who lives about five houses over here beside me called Clean Clippings. He's on Instagram, at Clean Clippings. And he brings me bags of his grass clippings. He'll bring me bags of leaves, whatever he got. I just say, bring it on. But I like to use it to cover up the food once it starts to get pretty thick. Like this one's starting to get a little more piled up. This one's been pretty covered up. This is probably just one dump of food, probably yesterday or this morning. And I like to put green. Yeah, see, look. Once I move that little layer, you can see it's thick. It is gooey and slimy. But I like to put a layer of grass on there. It's a major help to keep the bugs down. Because even with the grass on it, like even with putting grass on it, the bugs still... they still want to hang out, but look at that molded grass. Look at that, y'all. But like this right here, I'll just use the bag grass to cover up the food that helps with the bugs. There will still be some bugs, but if you don't cover this stuff up, you will have a swarm of bugs, like big time. You can see little bugs flying around probably already. But grass like this is a good thing to use. Another thing I've got on hand right beside the compost bin is my big bokashi buckets. Right here, and I'll be constantly be putting just a little layer of bokashi just to keep breaking the material down. That's got lots of lactic acid bacteria on it, and it helps keep the smell down also. Excuse me. So bokashi covers the food, but the smell, that's the biggest thing. This helps with smells because I got a wife and I got kids and I got neighbors, and it's a real issue if you let this just get out of control. But there are things you can do to keep those food layers covered, because that's what stinks. Keep the food layers covered, and you can control your smells, and you can control how it's broken down, and you can control textures too with whatever you're using to cover up the food. So you can see this one's getting pretty full. It's thick. It's packed in, like it's solid. It's not going to go down. And you can take that. You know, I can take these lids off right here, and I can see the process of decomposition and composting and what it looks like, and all that stuff. So these bins are fun. They can split in half also, but once they get packed in, this is a whole cubic yard of compost. And that's a bunch. So I'm about a foot away from being totally full. Now, in about 1 month, when the black soldier flies show up, this will start to shrink. It'll start going down, and it'll probably shrink down by half. You'd be amazed at how much it will go down. So, one major thing I'm always trying to do is put stuff in here. Chopped grass, like grass that grows along right here. I'll just grab, rip it up, throw it in here, or I'll throw it in my JLFs. But you need material. You need lots of material. Compost is about a 10-to-1 ratio. 10 5-gallon buckets of material will get you 1 5-gallon bucket of compost, right?
It's all about building up organic matter, and that's why we always talk about that and like not closing the loop, not letting that stuff leave the farm, so to speak. Right. So Kevin, take us through kind of the process. Like where do you start with that with one of those buckets when it's completely used up and empty. Take us from that up, kind of like to where it is right now.
Yeah, so once, like this bucket right here, once this would be all scraped out and used to be totally bare, what I would start off with is either a layer of, I prefer grass clippings. Now, you could use leaves also, but leaves take forever to break down if they don't get turned. And I'm not a compost turner at all. My compost sits like this right here. It gets turned by worms and black soldier fly larvae. I don't do any aeration or anything like that. I've got holes. We got holes on the side and stuff like that. So mine just naturally sits and just gets chewed up by shredders. And I mean, I'll turn it a few times just to see what it looks like, but it's not a turn to get it aerated and to get the middle on top and the top in the middle. It's nothing like that. It's just like, okay, what's going on down there? How many red wigglers do I got? Are the black soldier flies taking over? You know, how is it wet? Is it moist in there? Are there dry pockets? Just that's the reason I might look in there, but not for a turn. So I would like to have a big layer of grass, which I do right now, and I'd put this whole bag down on the bottom. I just put the whole thing there because that grass is going to absorb a lot of the moisture that things like this, limes with all the juice in it, tomatoes, sweet potatoes, coffee grounds, bananas, pears, all that stuff bringing moisture, which is a good thing. You want the moisture, but if you just put the raw material, boom, down first, you're going to see it will start to leak out all down here, all at the bottom. It just starts to leach out because there's nothing to catch that juice as it's breaking down. So I go with grass, put a big fat layer of grass, and then I start just filling it full of our food scraps. Food scraps is what makes the best compost in my environment. It makes a nutritional compost. We'll go over those if we have time, a couple different types of compost, but this is a nutritional compost. It's full of food scraps. It has mowed grass and leaves and some IMO3 and some bokashi and whatever else has been thrown in here. But the majority is very nice, dark, humus material. Watch, I'll scrape them. Let's see if we can see some wormies.
So, Kev, you would call this... oh, yeah, there you go. I see him. Wigglers hanging out right on top there. Yeah. So you would call this probably like a static. I mean, it is a static pile.
Yeah, it's static. It's static.
That's how I compost myself as well, just because I don't have the time and the space and the energy anymore with the kids to turn piles. So I plan accordingly. And in my environment where we don't get black soldier fly that come and chomp that stuff down, it'll take me at least 6 months to get good usable soil. And most of the time I plan on, if I'm not using it 6 months, I'm just riding it out for the entire year and like going through the winter, going through a spring, a fall, everything. Cause it just takes that long for that. So it takes a lot of pre-planning to compost when you don't have the environment for things like black soldier fly larvae and stuff. But as the summer cooks on here, I'll notice it break down a lot faster because the soil organisms come alive. Those chompers that we have here in Michigan, it's all connected to the ground. That's the beauty of having the connection with the ground, not having something up in a tote indoors away from that connection. You get a lot more enhancement on the breakdown. You get a lot more enhancement on the microbial life, obviously. Right. Anyways, so
I'll show you that in a second. So grass, and then I'm going to fill it full of food until the food starts to rot and stink so much, or, you know, the bugs are showing up too much. Once that happens, I give it another good layer of grass or bokashi or rice hulls, whatever the case may be. I'm going to get it covered really well, and then I'm going to keep layering the food, whatever else I can put in there, the green manures, the IMO3s, like I said, that I use, and just constantly be layering it. And man, when the shredders show up, like the red wigglers that are in there right now, they're turning it. If you've ever seen soil, a time lapse of soil, like if I held my camera like this on my compost and we did about a 4-day time lapse, it would be rumbling. It'd be moving like this. You don't see it now because it's just stagnant. You know, it's just standing still. We don't see the movements. But once a worm makes a tunnel big enough, poop, something falls down in it, you know. And you see this soil moving. It's a living soil. But those layers allow those shredders to move up, the red wigglers to have a lot of food to eat, and then they'll move to another layer. So I just layer it, constantly layering and layering and layering. This whole thing was about, let's see, when I started the gardens, it was about a foot above. It was full of compost. And now I've got it back. It's about down to halfway now. But that's all it is, y'all. It's putting all the organic matter in there you can, keeping it covered up, keeping it moist. When it rains, here's another thing. When it rains, right, there's nothing above them. But when it rains, I take the lids off, let it get moist. Because it's going to break down so much faster if it has moisture. If this stuff is dry, it's going to be in here for years and years and years. Just like leaves out in the woods, you know, they're there for years, man. They don't just break down into soil real quick. Other things do, but leaves will take forever. But if you get them wet and you turn them, if you only have leaves to compost, you know, maybe that's the issue. Get them really wet and keep moving them, keep turning them, and get them broken up, and they'll be good to go.
I learned that through the years of composting, what you said about leaves taking forever to break down. There'll be some of the last clumps left in the bottoms of these piles. So I've kind of adopted a different principle with leaves, where I use them atop my gardens in the fall. Once that it's finally done dropping leaves, I'll top my beds with as thick of a layer of leaves as I possibly can. And then come springtime when I plant, I pull my leaves back, I plant, but I push the leaves all back in to keep them as a mulch layer. And I'll even stockpile leaves off to the side, because what I'm seeing is through the springtime, as it's warming up, the organisms are just destroying those leaves. So it's acting, the whole bed is acting like a compost. So having that reserve of leaves to be able to throw back on to keep cooling down the soil, acting as a mulch layer, especially in spots where you don't have any cover, it's a valuable resource to stockpile if you have leaves. So just a thought there too. Sorry, Kev, that was some serious mulch porn you were showing as I was talking.
Yeah, there's some red wigglers in that clump, wasn't there? So yeah,
So that's your static kind of cold, that you'd call that a cold compost, because you're not trying to mix any sort of carbon nitrogen balance there. You're not trying to get it hot. Do you want to talk a little bit about that? About like thermic composting?
Let me show you. Thermophilic. This is finished compost that has been sifted twice. And so it's basically more like, you know, humus, just a dark, rich material. But that is just compost.
That's worth its weight in, so you know, good. Silver. It really is, man. Like, look at that stuff.
It looks wet, doesn't it? Like, it's so dark, it looks like it's wet. But once it slides out of my hand, there ain't nothing on my hand. You know.
How long are we talking from the starts of your those bins, the way that you do it, to when you start to see that kind of stuff, Kevin?
Yeah. So again, it depends on the time of the year we're in. So what I'm trying to do right now, I started these in November, December it was, and I started these back then, and so December, January, February, March, April, May, I've been working on just getting them filled up, right? That's what my goal is, just get it full as I possibly can, because, like I said, in about a month, the black soldier flies are moving in, and they consume amazingly quick, and they'll go down a little bit, each will go down. Now, probably what I'll do is I'll move one to the other, because they'll both be at least halfway down, and I'll let that one really finish up, and I'll start a whole new bin, and I'll empty this one out, and I'll start another new bin with it, and I'll have two new bins and a finished bin, just like I do now, two new bins and a finished bin. Because like I said, it looks like two bins, like we're loading these up as much as possible just to get one of these, you know. So again, material when it comes to composting. Compost as much as you can. which might lead into like, well, I've heard you can't compost dairy. I heard you can't compost beans or bones and cheeses and things like that. You can compost anything, y'all. You can compost anything you've got. Here's the thing. Here's where the common sense comes in. Is microbes chewing up meat are going to be a different type than chew up plant material, and they're going to. It's just a different categorical difference. Plant material and animal material, and so since we're growing plants, you know, we're just going to kind of. Most people will stick with plants and little meat. You don't have to stay away from meat. If we eat tacos or we eat some kind of shish kebab or something like that, I'm not taking the time to separate the meat out. It's all going in the compost bucket, and it's all coming out here and getting dumped in these bins. It makes zero difference. It's just more material. Those larvae will chew that stuff up, poop it out. And again, you always have way more vegetable material than meat anyway. So, but again, if you're compost, you can compost meat, guys. You can do it. You can bury meat. You can bury meat and all kinds of stuff in the ground. Keep it covered is the best way. And it'll be broken down. It'll take a year, you know, for it all to get chewed up. anything.
So is that David's question is, what are the advanced techniques for breaking down fats and normally not compostable material using bokashi? That's what he's referring to is meat products and stuff like that. Are there ways to expedite breaking down the meat, or do you do anything different? You said you keep it all together. Does it take any longer than the vegetables and stuff like that?
Yeah, it'll be smelly too. It takes a while longer. It's going to take a lot of maggots to get in there to move it. Bacteria and stuff, they'll eat on it, but it'll take forever. But like maggots and stuff, they'll chew it down quick. And then the maggots then have the nutrients in their bodies or the excrement that they pooped out. And so, again, the why I say you can compost anything is the point is, ultimately, Mother Nature breaks it down and gets the nutrient to be in an available form to be reused once again. And she does that with everything. That's her purpose. There's no other way that something, if it falls on the ground and dies, it's going to be broken down and be reused again. So you can compost anything.
Well, and if you look at Jadam, right, and this is where – it's the being the poor communist farmer, like as you like to say, this is kind of where I go a little divergent, because I don't have to use things like my excrement, right? But in Jadam, they on the farms out in the hillside where they don't have anything to bring in, there's no additional inputs for them to add. They're using their own excrement and, you know, feces, urine, animal, human, all of it, for usable NPK. So, I mean, there's a testament to that. And it's actually approved organic, if you can believe that, to use that system. So, just throwing that out there. So you want to get into thermophilic composting, or... Yeah. Hot composting, if you will.
Yeah. So there's lots of different types of composting. When I first got into thinking, okay, I'm going to compost for real now, so I got to read these books on people or by people who know how to compost, like Dr. Elaine and Leighton Morrison, even some of Jeff Lowenfeld's books gets into some composting and things like that. But I started getting into those books and being like, okay, so I have to cook this stuff for this long and turn it this many times. And you start watching people online and they're staying up at nighttime to turn their compost or their IMO3 and stuff like that. And again, man, it just was like, nope, that's not for me. I'm going to strip this whole thing, this whole process down. I'm going to take what is essential that I need and must do to make the end product result in what I want. And I'm going to eliminate all the other methods. Everything else I'm going to eliminate. And so that long process ended up over about a 4 to 5 year period of me trying different types of composting methods until about 3 years ago when I was like, I'm not turning it anymore. I'm done. I'm just throwing it on top and letting it happen. And it's coming out of the bottom in beautiful compost form. And that's how it's been going on. Like, just like you're saying, if you start composting, you're going to try all those methods. You're going to try those, you know, the, with the tunnel in the middle. Can't remember what that's called. There's piles that you'll turn and adjust, the rolling tumblers that you can have, so many different methods. And all of that is preference. It will happen. All those methods are going to end up in the same result of compost. Now, you say you want to talk about thermophilic compost. So these are some of those styles of composting we're talking about that I don't do. But thermophilic compost is a compost that's going to need to hit 150, and it's going to need to remain at 150 for approximately 3 to 5 days. And it's going to need to be turned a little bit because you're trying to keep heat. Sometimes turning it actually helps a little bit of heat continue in the compost or in the compost. And so thermophilic is getting those temperatures so high that the only bacteria that can survive are thermophiles. And those are microbes that can live above 150, 160, whatever the case may be. I don't know the exact definitions and terms, but that's the general idea so that you can understand. Microbes that can handle super high temperatures. So the thing is this, the soil out there in your garden right about now is probably around 82 degrees or something like that. Starting here anyway, it's starting to warm up, starting to be better. You know, the seeds are starting to wake up. what am I talking about? Went blank.
Talking about the thermophiles and making thermophilic.
Right. Here you go. That's right. Thank you. So those temperatures don't compare to that compost that's been rocking at 150 for 5 days or whatever the case may be. You've got 80 degree temperatures. So you have microbiology that likes to be working at 80 degrees right now in your soil, right? That's at least in the theory, that's how it works. And that, you know, that's the idea, is you're trying to match at least your environment as best you can, because that's your environment. Your environment, if you bring something alien in that your environment can't use, it's just a kind of a, oh, well, it's going to use it, but not in the way you intended it to be used, probably.
It's almost like just NPK at that point, right? Like, it's just, you're missing you're missing a huge chunk of it, and it's almost like just a medium that needs to be inoculated at that point, because it's been basically wiped of all of its. But if you have it touching the ground and you let it go thermic, go hot, and then go cold again, you know, if it goes through the entire process, I suppose it re-inoculates itself at some point. But
yeah, it does. You just killed off your biology by doing that process, and you can always make it good compost again. You can just inoculate it with new compost, IMO2, some IMO3, whatever, dump it back in a compost bin, you know. It's not bad. Nothing's wrong with it whatsoever. The reason that they get it up to 150 into that thermophilic compost is because they're trying to eliminate pathogens also, like E. coli and things like that, that also could survive in these compost bins or these compost, you know, companies and machines and piles they have. So they want to make sure they try to eliminate as many pathogens for the public as they can. So they crank it up to the high degrees. And that's totally understandable. That's makes sense, right? But again, the problem is we need microbiology in our soils, and so we need compost that's and IMO threes and fours and fives if you're cooking them that are hitting around 100, maybe 115, around there. And my compost is always around 100 degrees, basically, when it's cooking throughout the summer for a couple of months when everything's rocking, around 85 to 100, depending on the ambient environment. But it's always, you know, it's a good place for microbiology to live and thrive, and trying to imitate the soil that I'm using during the summertime and all that good stuff. So there you go. Thermophilic compost, all cooked up.
So what about pests? I mean, I obviously there's going to be some unique pests when you have open compost bins. You're solving your issues kind of with those tops. I'm sure that doesn't solve all your issues. What techniques and tips, or like, is it just as simple as covering up the food with some soil? What do you do to minimize?
Yeah, so there's a spectrum of pests, and you're gonna start to eliminate these one pests and realize by the method you eliminated them with, you invited these other pests to come on in also. So it's gonna be a give and take of what pests do you want? You are not gonna not have pests. You're gonna have lots and lots of pests. And if you live kind of out towards the woods a bit, like me, you're going to have even a larger spectrum of pests. So first pests are going to be the flies, all the little gnats and flies and stuff like that. The best way to eliminate that, like I said, is to cover it up. Just cover it up. That will eliminate them very well. You're still going to have them around, but as compared to not covering that material up, it is a swarm. When you lift that lid up, they'll fly up your nose, in your ears, in your mouth. They'll be all in an open shed by a gasoline alley. They'll just fly in there for some reason. So it's just crazy. Those little pests, get them covered up. Now, when I cover that grass up, or cover my food up with grass, that's when I start to invite mice. And it's like, okay, whatever the case may be, I'm fine with mice. I've had mice in my compost every single year, and it is what it is. I've put mouse traps in there. Probably the first year I saw a mouse, I put mice trap in there, and I was like, yeah, I'm not gonna do that. Whatever, it's part of nature. I mean, just let them eat and poop and rock on, and thank you, Mother Nature, for a good system that's going on here. It's kind of how I felt about it. You could get cockroaches in there. I've seen cockroaches in mine, and it's what it is. I don't have cockroaches all over my house or nothing like that, but wood brings in roaches outside. Wood brings in termites and roaches and all that stuff. And so I often have a lot of woody bits in my compost when I'm specifically trying to create a specific texture. I'll use certain woody bits and stuff like that. And that invites, now again, a new set of issues of the roaches. You're gonna get raccoons that will come in. I have watched a raccoon sit on top of those bins out there and reach down and pull something out and look at it and throw it on the ground and reach down again and look at something and start eating on it. And so they'll get in there and mess it up. I've had possums in there, I've had rabbits, I've had a dog in there before, I've had a snake in there before. Had my kids in there before. So lots of pests come with compost. How about you, Mark?
Yeah, so I have a containment to some extent around mine. I built mine out of, it's like a pallet frame, and then I inside of like the pallet kind of fencing on the outside, I've got chicken wire to give it some air on the sides to keep it away from the wood so it doesn't really leach. And then on the front I have chicken wire that's 4 feet high too, so. But on the top, it's wide open. So for me, I have to dig my stuff deep. Like I go out and I'll have like a 2 foot hole dug in the middle of my compost pile, and I'll just like bury it 2 feet down. It solves some of the issues, but there's still other rodents. I don't know exactly what they are. Definitely been raccoons. Definitely been some man, I don't even know what the hell they are out there. But yeah, some weird rodents that get in there. That's probably my biggest concern. Rabbits are killing my garden. I'm battling with them right now. I can't get them to stay the frick out. 4 foot tall, you know. I had 7 foot tall fence, but it's 7 foot tall netting, but a 4 foot tall fence, so it's like double wrapped, buried down. I cannot figure out how these rabbits are getting into my garden, but they're clearing my shit. Luckily, I've put out a few tester plants, and yep, gone. So back to the drawing board on those.
Yeah, I've got one rabbit in my backyard right now, and I'm not sure if he's the one eating on my sunflowers or if the couple of caterpillars, which I have seen out here now, has been definitely chewing on my okra and sunflowers.
We have something chewing on our plants already too out here, and it's 60s and low 70s, so it's already starting out. So should we get into some questions? Because we do have a few questions here. And if anybody wants to toss some more in, please don't hesitate. Let's see. From Kurt Williams on Instagram, what is a good amount of time for chicken poo compost before you can use it? Oh, you're muted.
I would do about 8 months. 8 months. So again, about, I would let, like, I let it rain. I let mine weather. That's how I let it do it. It sits out in my bags, in plastic bags usually. And I'll let the rain fall on it and the weather, wind blow, whatever. Things are chewing on it, trying to eat at it. And I just let it sit there, and then I will dump it straight onto the garden, which is what I did this year. I used aged chicken manure and rabbit manure, straight rabbit manure from Homestead and Homie. Shout out to at Homestead and Homie for 13 bags of fresh rabbit manure to help me start these new no-tills that I started this year.
Some animals like rabbits have a ready to use manure, don't they? Like rabbits, alpaca, horses maybe. Do you know what that list is? Is that right?
I don't know the list, but the idea is that if it will poop in one spot and pee in another spot, that poop is usable. But once, like, a chicken poops and pees back there at the same spot and it all mixes together, then it's got that high nitrogen in it also because of the urine, I guess. So that's what you're letting that do, is you're letting the uric acid or the urine, whatever, break down over time, so it's not such a hot dose to your plants and your roots. So I go 8 months. Good question, Kurt.
All right. I got access to a bunch of whey being thrown out. How would you suggest storing it until I can put it to use?
Huh. Just whey. Is that would be that I would so it's not going to store for a long time, because what's going to happen is it's going to start to sour. And what I'm understanding you meaning whey is the liquid that comes along with the cheese making process. So that's that whey would be like a rice wash, basically, if you froze, if you kept it in a refrigerator, it'd probably last longer. But the idea would be this: to let it, once you get it, let it ferment for about 4 to 5 days, maybe something like that. And then I'd make some labs with it. But you can also let that whey ferment naturally, and you have a bacteria that is forming in that whey or that rice wash that is still very usable as a probiotic. You don't have to add the milk and make labs with it. It's a Subtilis casei or something like that. I'm not a genius, not a genius. But oh yeah, shout out Scissor Tail Solvolus. Boom, baby.
So this one's coming off of, sorry, I'm trying to multitask, and with adult ADD, it's very hard. From Instagram, Gravy Kilos said, "We got them chickens running around our property right now. We haven't transplanted any of our plants in yet. Should we keep them away from the tomato plants all to weather or today? All together or today?" Sorry, this doesn't make sense. Didn't transfer as I said properly. I heard nightshade plants aren't safe for chickens. Okay, never. You might have to clarify that one, Gravy Kilos. I apologize. I should have read that before I started even reading it. All right. So, Mark Nelson, I believe my compost went anaerobic. If I keep adding browns, will it come back?
Well, Mark, my question would be, why do you think, what indicators did you receive that you feel like it went anaerobic? It must be a smell, maybe, that you're going by. And in time, it goes to soil. So it's going to go through a stinky, like mine goes through an anaerobic process because I don't turn it. So there's definitely pockets of anaerobic activity going on because it's so smashed and oxygen can't get in there or something like that. But I don't worry about it if it does go anaerobic, because a few inches down into your soil, you're dealing with more anaerobic microbes than aerobic microbes anyway, because there's much, you know, that's the environment for them down there. So now, if it's an issue you feel like, what you can do is try to spread that best, the best, cheapest, easiest ways to spread your compost out. Get it thinned out, get it dried a little bit, let Mother Nature, let the wind, let the sun dry it out a little bit, and or a lot. You can let it dry out totally, and that will definitely change it. Because I have IMO3s right now. When we were out there at that compost, I have a there was a drip tray, and it was full of IMO3 that had got too wet at the very bottom, and it was anaerobic. It had a stink to it, had a, you know, a twinge to it, like, ooh, yuck, and it shouldn't be like that. And all I did is just, I've been letting it dry for about 5 days, raking it back and forth and just getting a good dry on it, and that smell will start to go away, and then I'll incorporate it back into more IMO3, and it's good to go. So the same thing with compost. If it has a bad smell to it, I'll just try to cover the smell up as best you can with material and let the process continue to happen. But if it's that bad, if it's like broken down compost, like it's starting to get dark and you feel like it stinks, spread it out, let it dry out. If it's newer compost and you're like, this is starting to stink bad, just let it stink, cover it up as best you can.
Great answer. So I got clarification from Gravy Kilos. Are nightshade plants safe for chickens to be around, or should I avoid them altogether? Do you know anything about that?
There's lots of plants that are in the nightshade, man. When you start looking at them, like potatoes, I think I just read today are in nightshade. So
tomatoes, eggplant, potatoes. And I think it's solanine, right? Is what it's called. And that's the compound that's toxic to chickens. So I would look more into that. I don't know how chickens interact with those plants if they, you know, they peck at everything. So I would assume that they're pecking at those. You know, it's funny. Have you ever heard of the invasive plant called garlic mustard?
No.
It's like a white flower plant, grows all over the place around here. And so I was just reading some information about it, and here's a perfect lesson in why you should read everything before you start doing anything. Because the way that this article read was that it's got a nice garlicky aroma to it. I was like, I didn't know that. So I crushed a little bit up and smelled it. And then the next sentence was, and it also contains cyanide when you crush it up. So doing a little research on the plants that you have in your yard, it's really a good idea, especially if you have little kids, chickens, animals, dogs, stuff like that. Just throwing that out there. There's other plants that I don't know them all, but I know like poison hemlock. There's plants that grow on the edges of farm fields around here, and hopefully maybe somebody can help me here. But if kids get into that and they breathe in that, when that breaks up and they breathe it in, it can be toxic. So good reason to carry like a little field manual with you to educate yourself on the stuff that grows around, because some of it's super useful, some of it's not so useful. So all right, Kev. Oh, you're muted.
Okay, David Graff, how many red wigglies would you add to your bins to start with? So let's talk about my three bins right there, back there. A cubic yard each. I was composting and learning kind of different methods and stuff like that. Started learning about worms and different types, and I got into understanding a little bit of the red wiggler. And I just went on Instagram and found the first red wiggler guy, and it was Jim's Red Wigglers. So shout out to him. He's the one that those red wigglers are from him. I bought one bag, and it wasn't a big one. I don't remember how many was in it, but you know, just about that big, about 7 inches tall, about that wide, full of a blob of red wigglers, and put them in. I put a little in all three composts, and I have red wigglers all over my property, like just massive amounts of them. Like if I put trays on the ground out there by Gasoline Alley, and the next morning I move those trays, there's red wigglers just all under those trays, not even in the compost bins, just in the ground, and they're out in the gardens and all that. And that, because those red wigglers, They're ferocious eaters for sure, but they will reproduce quick when their conditions are right. Like, man, I did not show it this year, but there was about 2 weeks, 2 weeks of my composting about a month and a half ago, that every time I would pull that finished compost back, those red wigglers were attached. And that they, in like the red wigglers, like there's two worms and one of them just kind of like that. And that's how you know they're mating, because this one is just totally opened up and consumed another. And every single scoop, there's red wigglers mating in there. And so they're ferocious sexual creatures.
Yeah, when you come across those big lumps of them, that's just them sharing their juices and getting there. I mean, they're asexual, so they're technically banging themselves, but they need that transfer of fluid to be able to reproduce. So make no mistake about it. That's exactly what they're doing when you find those clumps. Yeah. So then, like, I guess if you're talking about like an indoor bin, you know, you don't have to have a ton, but just be mindful that if you start it, like I saw someone say 1,000 minimum, it's relative to the volume of your container. It's also relative to how quickly you want to see some results. If you want these things to be mowing through lots of food scraps and you have an indoor like worm, urban worm bag or something like that, I would say start with 1,000, because you're going to need some heavy moving going on there. And you need them to start reproducing to keep moving that. If you're going small and you don't care and you want to kind of grow into it a little bit, 100 would be just fine, to be honest. Just be mindful that your food amount, your feeding amount is going to be a lot smaller, and that's where you're going to run into issues with the worm bins, is overfeeding. Overfeeding is where you do run into like anaerobic conditions that will kill your worms, potentially over, you know, too moist, is one thing that will really do damage to not only to their reproduction, but also to their life. It can actually kill them. So just be mindful of that. And that's something you need to tiptoe into. Just start small and work your way up from there. Let's see. Bloomhauer from Instagram. What are the best things to feed your compost to get it started? Just got my balcony worm bin set up in a 9-gallon tote. I've got Labs, Bokashi, IMO 2 and 3.
To feed your compost to get it started. Best things to feed your compost to get it started. You got
Benny Boost.
Gosh, yeah, I'm a 2. I'm a 3. Well, I mean, yeah, starting even before that, food scraps. Food scraps are going to do the best compost, and it's going to stink and rot and all that stuff, but you got to have a container somehow and get food scraps in there, and then use the Bokashi that you have. Use a little bit of that IMO3 every once in a while. Continue to load it up with some grass clippings if you've got it, some more food scraps, a little more Bokashi. Like I said, just keep on layering it. And that's the way to do it. Just got my balcony worm bin set up in a 9-gallon tote within it. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and if it's a true worm bin, just find that balance with the food, because you can't, like, you, if you're looking to, depends on what you're trying to do. So if you're looking to like grow worm populations, then you need volume and bedding, right? If you're just looking to produce like pure vermicompost granules castings, then you don't necessarily want that, because you don't want to dilute those worm castings, right? So it depends on what your goal is there, but like what Kevin said is a great way to do it if you're trying to build populations, because you're building up volume there. You're giving them places to go and you know, a lot of food, like with grass clippings and stuff like that. You're giving them a lot of food that's slow release, that's not really going to be like a huge vector to pests and stuff like that, using a ton of food scraps would. But definitely get those food scraps in, because you need that nutrition, right? So then one thing that I like to use, that I use a lot in my worm bins, is Benny Boost to build those, you know, other decomposer populations, but also because, and I'm not trying to sell Benny Boost. If you look at the ingredients, it's barley, blue corn and lentils, all organic. Just because I can, and I feel good about it. And then a little bit of wheat bran, a little bit of oatmeal. So it's, if you just look at those ingredients and you use some of those things, worms go crazy for corn. They go crazy for barley. They go crazy for all those ingredients. So if you make it accessible by crushing that stuff up, that's how I generally sell it. That's how I would always recommend using it, is crushing it up and just pulverizing it basically. And then it's especially nice when the bin's running maybe a little bit wet and you don't want to add more wet food scraps this week. Instead of doing food scraps, run a vein of just like a nice thick vein of something like Benny Boost on the top. I just like to cover it up. I moisten it to get it into like kind of like a patty. And I promise you, if you check that in a couple days, don't go too crazy on it. But in a couple days, you check that'll be a worm epicenter of just crazy banging and crazy bioactivity. So I like to go back and forth, food scraps, Benny Boost. It keeps my shit just pumping.
Yep. Go to mibeneficials.com, check out Benny Boost. Okay. Mark Nelson, how much compost do you add to your outdoor grow area? Well, that question needs clarification, so I'm going to put the parameters on it. Let's talk about, let's say we were dealing with my new no-till beds, 30 feet long, 4 feet across. How am I going to use compost in all those? Now, do I have enough compost for all those? First of all, no, I do not. I don't have enough compost to do what needs to be done to those beds. So this is how I'm using my compost currently. Like in the beds where they're long, if I needed to plant corn, I'm going to dig out a hole about that big. I'm going to put me some compost in the hole. I'm going to put my corn, my little corn starting in there. Cover it up. That's how I'm going to use the compost to begin with. Then about a week later, 2 weeks later, I'll come back and I'll put a ring of compost around it again on the very top, like a top dress, and then I'll probably cover that with some mowed grass or something like that. But that's how I use it because I have to be very, specific. I can't just throw it out there and let the rain wash it off or whatever. I've got to use it in a specific area because I don't have enough. So instead, if I had enough, I'd spread it all over the top of it, of the entire bed, a thick layer of it. 8 inches usually is what you read in those no-till books, a good 8 to 12 inches. But 8 inches is typically what they say because everybody has to deal with the expense of buying compost. You got to make it where you got to buy it, and making it is takes a lot of material. So I use it in small areas that are right where the plant is growing, and then I'll do that probably again next year because I'm not going to have enough compost. But eventually, I'll be putting more stuff in those gardens. But eventually, I'll have put a good amount of compost over 2 or 3 years into those no-tills. But I can't do it all at once. It's just going to have to be over the years.
And the kind of the goal of what you're doing with the way that you build your gardens and with the way why you share how you're building your rows and how why you're building the new garden the way you build it, and the reason I do permaculture, the hugel culture in my backyard, is that we're building a compost pile essentially. You're building an epicenter for everything there in the garden. So the way exactly the same way Kevin uses it, because it's such a valuable resource. Like I can pack my bins up to the top, but come next year they're half the size of what they were, and it's just such valuable resource to have. I'm using it when I'm transplanting, when I have plants that need, really nice fertile soil. Or I have spots in the garden that maybe need a little bit of a fill-in where I'm trying to plan on like the edge of my berms on my beds where maybe the topsoil layer isn't as thick, the humic layer isn't as thick, But when I dig into that hugel culture, and I think when Kevin's digging into his second, third, fourth year gardens, you're seeing compost. I mean, that is what you're digging into. It's a beautiful thing.
Yeah,
When
that's
that.
exactly right. That is exactly right. And that's one of those things I was talking about where you begin to eliminate all those other needless steps. And that's when I just started doing the soil layering stuff. And I was calling it soil layering. And in the books, I realized people call it soil lasagna. I think it's what they say often. But that's where you see me just chopping up watermelons and stuff, just dumping it on top. Because when the conditions are right during the summertime, you can definitely burn your plants by overheating the soil. But when the conditions are right, the biology and the shredders will just chop that. It'll chew it up, and within 2 weeks, it's all gone. And it's just a hard crust on the top of where all that fruit used to be. And so that is composting. That's all that is. And it's all, everything is. It's all composting. Like we call it composting because you maybe put it in a bucket or a bin and you've got worms and stuff like that. Well, that's fine, but Mother Nature does that also out there. As everything falls down on top of each other, things come up and eat it and poop it out and reuse it. And it's just, if everything is composting. So it made sense to me, like, okay, I'm just going to compost in my no-till spots. That just makes perfect sense. And it works just fine. And I've heard podcasts where people will talk about how you just cannot compost food over your plants because it'll bring in bacteria and all this stuff. And you're just like, this is ridiculous anymore. All this this silly gardening talk about keeping bacteria out of your garden or keeping dead plants out of your garden. That's nuts, y'all. Keep it all in there. More bacteria, the better. The more rot, the better. The more organic material, the better. It's going to create a richer soil, more dense of nutrients, more dense of biology. It's going to have a better texture to it that you're able to actually grow bigger plants in it. So the more the merrier when it comes to composting in your garden spots. Just go dump it in there and dig it. You know, if you got a bunch of food scraps or something like that, or a 5 gallon bucket of food, you can always dig a hole, dump that in the hole, cover it up. And you'll never see it again, and it'll turn into good nutrients.
And that's where you'll find the worms and everything else. Yes, awesome. Awesome. Definitely. With the stuff you're looking for in the soil, that's where you'll find it.
Yep. They'll go right to that. That's food for them. That made life easy for them. They're going to hang out there as long as that food source is there. Okay. So Mark Nelson, can compost burn my plants? I'm going to go with no. And the answer is, I'd say no. I grow out of compost.
Like you compost on your plants. You grow out of compost.
Yeah, straight out of compost.
Straight out of compost. Yeah.
That's why I have on those bins, because I used to do that. I didn't used to have all the garden area that I had. My kids are just getting to a point where I'm like, okay, no one's going to set the house on fire if I don't watch them, you know, or if I don't have an alarm on or a microphone or something. We're out of that phase finally. And they'll just go outside. And like right now, there's three of them out there in the creek. It's dark right now, but they've been playing in this creek for weeks, man. They've been digging holes and making forts and all this stuff. And dude, they just go out there and hang out and play. So I'm able to grow, experiment, do much fun things. And I used to have just a small little garden spot, and I made enough, more than enough compost. I made so much compost, I was able to use my compost to grow indoors. And so that's when I was like, well, heck, I'm just going to grow straight out of compost. And I was filling like 10, 15, 20 gallon pots full of compost, sticking seeds in there, sticking plants in there, and everything was happening. It was all good to go. And so that's when it went straight out of compost. And then a few years later, I started realizing if I add a little IMO3 to that, it makes a better soil structure. It doesn't use all my compost. It doesn't use all my IMO3. It was just a good mixture of two things that made a good growing medium. And that's simply called IMO4. IMO3 plus compost, that's IMO4. So no, compost won't burn your plants. Broken down, finished compost. That's what we mean by compost.
This is a tough one. I don't know. I wouldn't use labs to neutralize the ammonia. It's just heavy in nitrogen. I think it's just very high nitrogen is what's going on when dogs pee on the lawn, is what's causing that bleach burn. The only thing you can really do is just like water after your dog if you're concerned, or get them to go pee on your compost, or get them to go pee in the woods. But
Yeah.
not on your ganja plants. I wouldn't do that.
My boys have peed on plants by my back door and killed them all. So I've got one side of my back door that's got like five Nandinas and another nice bush, and over here it's got one Nandina and nothing else. It's the closest one, they peed over and then boom, hit all those other ones.
What, do you have anything to add to that, Kev? Or
No, I don't
okay.
know anything about that one, man.
All right, and then the last question from David. Really appreciate all these questions, David.
Yeah.
Don't have to feel any shame with dusting us with questions because it helps us to keep this stuff relevant. Would using compost as a tea go farther than just dumping it on, like brewing it first with some sugar, then tossing it out wet? I think you understand what he's asking.
Yeah, you got the idea. So that was one thing that we had down to possibly talk about is compost teas and compost extracts. There's tons of stuff we didn't even get close to talking about, but the best way to maximize the effect of your, well, the best way to maximize the application of your compost is if you use a tea or an extract. A tea is when you would take some compost and probably put it in a bag, put a 5 gallon bucket full of water, bubble it. You might add a little molasses or something like that, microbes and other things, but you're just bubbling it and you're dealing with aerobic microbes. And you're trying to multiply them, basically have a greater population to use when you go and apply it. But instead of taking a clump of compost, of dry compost, and trying to spread it all over an 8x4 growing no-till bed spot, it's going to be spread out, but it's going to have a little bitty bit here, 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 and it's going to be sparse, or it might be clumped up because you didn't get it broken up apart and it all went bump. So there's good compost here, but everywhere else there's none. So when you put that in a liquid form, whether it's the tea where you bubble it or the extract where basically you let it steep, you just run water through the bag, or you let the bag sit in the bucket, or like me, you just take a handful of compost, put it in the 5 gallon bucket of water, mix it with your arm for a bit, and then apply it. You can get that compost in a maybe a thinner layer, but it will be spread all over the place. Whereas that clump of dirt, boom, right there. Yeah, yay, good for that spot. But the problem is nothing's anywhere else. That liquid's going to go places that that soil cannot go.
And in theory, when you're bubbling those teas, or I mean, obviously, when you're making a JMS or a JLF, whatever you want to call it, you can see the microbial activity. So you're looking to expand those counts to a really high volume. Like you want to get as much out of that little clump of soil or worm casting or whatever it is that you're using as you possibly can. And then, so with like a obviously with a JLF and even with a T, it's you're not going to get a huge consortia of aerobic microbial life. So if you're looking for aerobic microbial life, even like microorganisms, nematodes, protozoa, stuff like that, that won't survive in any sort of oxygenless environment, anaerobic environment, run an extract where you quickly wash it, then apply it immediately. And speed is of the essence on those. And Aaron Dashing just added a good point. For brewing teas, it's not recommended to go longer than 48 hours. So take that for sure.
Yeah,
And
there's
definitely.
lots of information on brewing teas and people testing it, putting it under the microscope and seeing what results they have. There's ways to brew nematodes, you know. There's lots of fun things to do with teas. I don't use teas at all. I do the extracts. That's it. It's simply because bubbling took me more time. I had to go buy a bubbler. I had to get a new stone. I had to clean the stone. I had to clean the hose to the stone. You know, all of those things you had to do because of that bubbler. When I found out that it wasn't really necessary, that actually it wasn't necessary at all, it was just again preference. Then I was like, shoot, I'm taking that out, man. Just like you said, you can quick dump it like that. Make, like I said, put a handful in, stir it up, apply it. You can put the compost in, let it set for a day if you want, mix it all up. You're good to go. No big deal. But yeah, it, either way, you're good. Again, I'd like Mark said, I dump it in, stir it up, and then throw it in there.
Another great conversation this week. Wouldn't be possible without the questions. And Kevin, the interactive part was actually that was huge. That was pretty important to see that stuff, so people can see that it's nothing extravagant. You know, you've got probably some of the nicer composting bins out there, to be honest, like for what you're looking to do. Definitely look into a design that can help you with what you're trying to achieve. And for Kevin and I with kids, it's like, it's all about ease. It's all about getting the best quality, with the lowest amount of work and the lowest cost is usually a translating factor there too for us, because we have other expenses in our lives right now. So you want to give us some shout outs, Kev? What's going on? You still doing your Saturday shows?
Yeah, I've done some. I've been doing some consulting now that the gardening time is going. People want to spend a little bit longer, and when it's five people on a screen, it can, like, if I don't control the pace of it, nobody will get an answered question. It's like, we got to answer quick. And then I have to be like, okay, I'm moving on. Let's get the next one. You know, you just have to become a general and you got to go through them all. But when it's one-on-one, we slow it down. And basically, man, I haven't talked to anybody. Let me think. I think on these counseling ones, I have not talked to anybody in America. They have all been from other countries, trying to do organic stuff, trying to figure out how to grow, try to figure out how to do it totally cheap, not have to pay for anything. And so that's been a whole bunch of fun, is getting to do that. Now, let's see. I am going to be putting up a few new strains that I have grown. I just never put them up online because my website's still rather new. I haven't actually had it for quite some time. But I'm going to be putting up a few new strains at okcalcshop.com. They're not up there yet, but they will be. Probably by the weekend. And go to Growcast Podcast, because October 19th, again, I'm going to be putting on with Growcast a hands-on in the woods, hanging out with me and Jordan. We're going to be going out there, finding all the under the logs, find the mushrooms on the stumps, looking at the leaves, looking at the leaf molds. Just looking at everything, understanding how to make the labs, the IMO, the Bokashi. It's going to be a heck of a long day, crazy full of information. But it's going to be the first little thing that I put on out there in our land in Tahlequah, Oklahoma. And so you can check it out at growcastpodcast.com. Jordan's got some information. He's the guy that's putting on the whole thing. I'm doing all the teaching. I'm going to be making lots of stuff, and I'm going to be sending it home with everybody also. So like Bokashi, IMO3s, IMO2s, we're going to be making a bunch of labs while we're there. It's going to be awesome. I already got it almost all planned out, how it's going to be done. So that's exciting. It's coming up soon. Summer will be flying by, man. It's so pretty outside in my backyard. I'm looking out there. The trees are lush and big and thick. The vegetables are starting to grow. My garden areas are beautiful right now. My new no-till spots are struggling. We had 2 weeks of heavy rain, and so everything just waterlogged in that area. It's a low area, and it's been waterlogged. And so the okra and the cucumbers and squash been struggling. So I might have to buy me some new plants and restock the old garden, because I don't want to wait 2 weeks for them to grow. You know, I want to plant this long right now from Lowe's if I got to go do it. I started all my stuff from seed, but sometimes it gets wiped out by bugs or weather or whatever. Got to start all over. But I've got some. Me and Kid Mac, one more thing. Me and Kid Mac have collabed with a lot of my strains, and then a peach pistol that he has hunted out and used that we're breeding right now. We reversed it, and I crossed it with a ton of stuff. We're growing those out right now. I sent a bunch of those seeds out to all the people that bought the 420 packs and bundles and all that. So that's basically the way I get them tested, is I'm not selling them or anything. I'm just putting them in those bundles, sending them out, and then people will pop those suckers and start to test them immediately. And that's a good way to get it done. So I'm waiting on some pictures to come back. I've already seen some pictures of little bitty baby plants coming up, but I'm ready to see some pictures. They'll be nice. A lot of them are Chester Cheetah crosses. and Peach Pistol crosses with all of my work. So let's see. Okay, Calix, that dog get you his gear fire. Use blueberry picker together, half a gallon, dandelion. Okay.
That's a good tip right there. If you got a heavy field of dandelions, use a blueberry picker to pop those tops off.
Nice.
Sometimes it's nice to grab everything though. Grab the root, grab it all if you can, but if you're in a heavy field, that's a sick way to go. Yep, that's beautiful, man. That's excellent information. Over here, let's see. Well, Brian had his baby. Let's throw we'll throw him up real quick.
Brian some shout out on Instagram. So congratulations. Have a new kid. That's always nerve wracking when you're getting into your third, fourth kid.
This is number four for him. Yeah. Mixed family number four. He's a superstar dad, you know, and him and Tasa, his wife, are just excellent parents. So very, very happy for them. Very proud of him for being that dad and for being a good friend to us, man. He's always been a mentor and yeah, just to see that he's also a good person and not just a savvy business person and, yep, you know, like-minded is great, man. So yep. Shout out to Brian, Rubber Ducky Isopods, shopterrariumtribe.com. And then, MI Beneficials. Let's see, what do we have going on? Right now I'm working on some custom tie-dyes for the summer. Going to have a drop of about 25 of them going to be nice quality t-shirts that don't shrink, because the tie-dye I'm having done custom from my buddy at No Silly Ideas, he's right down the street here. He's done all my work, all my embroidery, all the screen printing, everything. So stoked to drop those, because he has a repertoire of designs that we're picking through right now and colors and stuff, and I think I'm going to make these ones super, super loud. So nice. keep your eyes peeled for that. Colored springtails are popping, man. We have a lot of different varieties: red, orange, yellow, blue, purple. We have arids, we have semi-arids, we have terrestrial, we have everything, man. So check us out at MI Beneficials. Would be happy to help you, and if you have any questions, don't hesitate to reach out to either one of us. We're both super accessible people, and I mean Kevin is very, very busy person, as you can imagine, but you've always been one to get back, dude. So if you've got a compelling thing to ask, you know, hit us up, man, for sure.
Yep.
Love you guys. Thanks everyone for joining us. And until next week, see you then.
Hey guys, appreciate you.